Welcome to Radio Sephirot's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sephirot's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, when Joseph Skakin was working as a slave laborer for the Nazis, how did he hide his Yiddish accent from his Russian and Polish companions? Michael Skakin, a son of Holocaust survivors, was born in Jaffa, Israel, and raised in New York. He served as a journalist, author, and translator. As a public affairs specialist, he's worked for a number of Jewish organizations, including the National UJA and Congress for Jewish Culture. He served at such publications as The Forward, both in English and Yiddish, the Litchfield County Times, and the New York Observer as cultural writer and book reviewer. On Burning Ground, a son's memoir, is the gripping story of how his father, through an incredible combination of ingenuity and luck, was able to survive Nazi occupation of Poland and World War II. The book received glowing reviews when it was first published in 1999, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel chose On Burning Ground as one of five books for advanced reading about the Holocaust. Michael Skakin founded the Joseph Skakin Project to honor his father and to educate future generations about the enormity of the Holocaust and convey the power of a resilient imagination in surmounting extreme adversity. Among the initiatives of the project is the production of a documentary and feature film about Joseph Skakin. This week we're speaking with Michael about his father's life and the book.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Michael. First, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about yourself before we talk about your father and the book. You were born in Israel. How, when, and why did your family happen to go to the United States?
Okay. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be speaking with you. Indeed, I was born in Israel. I was born in Jaffa, which is the ancient port city of Israel. Now it's part of Tel Aviv. My parents decided to come to the United States because of health reasons. My father was not feeling well. He's a survivor. He was a survivor of World War II, and we'll get into his story shortly. And my mother, too, is a survivor. And after the 1956 war, there was a great fear that wars would continue in the Middle East, as they have and still do. And so it was thought, for medical reasons, that it would be best to live here in the United States. And so I was 4 years old when we departed, and we became Americans, but we never lost our Israeli identity and our Jewish identity, which was really foremost during all our years in the United States.
Just out of curiosity, what language did you speak at home?
We spoke three languages at once. Yiddish was the lingua franca for us because my parents had both spoken it in pre-war Poland and knew it quite well. We also spoke Hebrew since that was my first language. After all, I was 4 years old when I left Israel, so I knew rudimentary Hebrew. And we were trying to become Americans as best we could. And so we were trying out the new language, which was English. So at one and the same time, we were polyglots, as many people who have drifted from one country to another or who are exiled from one country to another often become. So we were multilingual, speaking three languages at the same time.
Wow, that could be confusing.
Yes, but it forces you to pay attention. So you've got to untie these three threads that are constantly being woven together.
Was your own upbringing religious?
Yes. I grew up in Brooklyn, which is a borough in New York City, and we lived in a Orthodox Jewish area, which became increasingly more devout and Orthodox as the years went by. So I went to a yeshiva, which is a religious school, a parochial school. And though we were not ultra-Orthodox by any means, we were solidly Orthodox and became more so as the neighborhood evolved into more intense and increased orthodoxy.
I'm curious about your own relationship with your father when you were growing up. You say he started to speak with you about his experiences in Europe from the time you were very young. What did he tell you and how did he tell you? And wasn't this traumatic for a young child?
He did discuss his story, I think more so and more openly than other survivors, because he was able to create this scheme of survival, which he was in some ways proud of. And he had a sense of freedom in creating this means of survival. It was difficult to hear because it involved some of the most horrifying details that a human being could hear, the mass killings on the Eastern Front. My grandmother and my great aunts and uncles were all mass murdered on December 8th, 1941 in Aktion, which is the German word for a mass killing. But when I was 6 or 7, I don't think I could wrap my mind around the horrors that he displayed at the Sabbath table, which is where he always related these things to me. It was always at the Sabbath table that I learned the unusual nature of his story. But I think as I grew, I began to realize how unusual and how stranger than fiction his story was. And I began to become more impressed by his ability to use cunning and guile and everything that he could draw upon to survive. And till later on, I felt this needs to be written. And Elie Wiesel, who was the very well-known Holocaust memoirist himself, a novelist, said, this is a story that must be told. And so I went ahead, and together with my father, we crafted this book.
Do you think that speaking about it to you around the Sabbath table, do you think this was therapeutic for your father?
I think so. I think that when he survived completely on his own. No one could know of his scheme. He passed both as a Christian and even more importantly, as a Muslim to be able to survive World War II. And because he couldn't share this with anyone during the war for fear of being exposed or revealed, he had a compensatory need to speak. And I feel that I and my mother were his audience. And he had a sense that he wanted to relate this because during the war, he couldn't tell it to anyone. And the human need to share even the most tragic of experiences, and precisely the most tragic of experiences, is what brings people together and what creates family.
You say that his life is a story of solitary anguish. I guess that's what you mean.
Yes, precisely. Because during the war, he could only survive by negating who he was, by undoing his Jewish identity, because he became, in a sense, like a converso. He knew that he was a Jew. He knew he would always be a Jew. But for the sake of his survival, he knew he had to hide it behind many, many veils. And so the first veil was Christianity. He grew up in interwar Poland, a highly Christian society, a society that was also deeply anti-Semitic, but he had to draw upon ritual Christian prayer to give the impression that he was an authentic Catholic man. And though he was a rabbinical student and knew very little or next to nothing about Catholicism, he was a quick study and soon discovered that he was able to pass as a Christian, in part because he had blonde hair, and in Poland, blonde hair was often identified with being Polish. He was fair-haired and fair-skinned, and everything else conspired to help him pass as a non-Jew, which was absolutely essential for survival in those years.
Something that I thought was interesting was that he was afraid at one point later on. I mean, I'm not going to tell the whole story, but he was afraid that people would recognize him as a Jew from his Yiddish accent while he was speaking Polish. And I recently saw a very interesting program about women in the ghetto and how they moved in and out of the ghetto, and how it was a lot easier for women to pass, not only because they weren't circumcised, but because they had always had more of a relationship with the secular outside community. So it was a lot easier for them to kind of blend in than it was for the men, who tended to have more of an insular religious background.
Precisely. My father was a student in a very well-known and famous rabbinical academy in pre-war Poland, and his familiarity with Polish was really tangential. He didn't know Polish very well. So this, and here he was passing himself off as a Polish Catholic, also as a Polish Muslim, and how would he make this happen? So he was steeped in survival mechanisms which have stood the Jews in good stead for thousands of years. And what he realized is that he would have to speak to Poles in a language that was not native to them. And because he came from a borderland region, the part of eastern Poland that was adjacent to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union had taken over that part of Poland in 1939, he had learned Russian. So he made it a point of never speaking Polish to the Poles, rather to speak Russian to the Poles, to the Polish laborers that he was with in Nazi Germany, and he would speak Polish to the Russians. So he would be able to avoid people catching on to his broken command of both languages. The only language he really knew well was Yiddish. Obviously, that's the language he was forbidden to speak. So he spoke Polish to the Russians and Russian to the Poles. And this is the way he got around this very, very tricky problem.
Without giving away too much, can you tell us a couple of the other tricks that he used to fool the authorities or other people?
Well, one of the tricks is he was on a farm as a slave laborer. And he was together with Poles, Lithuanians, Ukrainians, Belarusians. And so he had to be very careful and calibrate all his responses. So one of the things that he did is he realized that if he could sing a song, because a song is always the same words and the same pattern of sound, and that he would be more secure if he knew a couple of songs very well. And so he became a kind of village crooner. He sang love songs to the other slave laborers, songs that would appeal to their sentiment and to their nostalgia for home and for the good life. And so by singing, he avoided the traps of banter, which he knew he couldn't pull off convincingly. So he knew Russian love songs, and he became a favorite of his fellow slave laborers because he brought them joy and song. And so even though he wasn't an operatic singer, he sang well enough to be able to pass. And song became the method or one of the methods of his survival.
How old was he at the beginning of the war?
He was about 17 years old when the war broke out. And at the height of his survival scheme, he was about 20. He was just emerging from late adolescence. And this was his coming of age, a very, very sobering coming of age.
Do you think that his religious background, and especially his yeshiva background, gave him the strength and maybe the smarts, the know-how, to be able to do what he did and to find imaginative ways of surviving?
I think so. I think that being steeped in Talmudic study, the study of the interpretation of biblical texts, was very important because it sharpened his analytical acuity. He was able to see things very clearly and examine things very closely the way a Jewish student would in a yeshiva or in a rabbinical academy. So he was well skilled in this area of close examination. And that stood him in good stead because he needed to be several steps ahead of the others around him if he was not to be revealed or exposed for who he was. And so I think the rabbinical training was absolutely essential. It sharpened the mind, it sharpened the memory, and all of these things were absolutely necessary for survival in those very desperate years.
How much of a part do you think luck played, for example, his physical appearance?
That too, yes. So he had certain advantages because he, quote unquote, didn't look Jewish, at least from the Polish point of view. He had blonde hair and blue eyes, and he could pass. And that gave him the strength and the advantage to negotiate some very, very tricky turns. Otherwise, he wouldn't have survived, and I wouldn't be here to speak with you about this book.
What did he do immediately after the war?
After the war, he came back to Judaism, but very slowly, because he wasn't quite convinced that the Germans or the Nazis were really done for. And so he tried to continue to pass as a non-Jew in post-war Germany, even though he ended up in a DP camp with other Jews. But he wanted to make sure that he could still play the game if necessary. But bit by bit, he was drawn back to the Jewish community and realized that he was and is and will always be a Jew. And particularly, he felt a strong sense of loyalty to his mother, who had been murdered together with 5,000 other Jews on December 8th, 1941. And she was extremely devout. And he felt that he owed it to her to remain a Jew, and that the blood tie was stronger than anything else, that it would overcome the worst of adversity. And so he not only came back to Judaism, but he became a practicing Orthodox Jew.
The book jumps from 1949 to 1959. What happened in between?
My father went to Paris after being in the displaced persons camp in post-war Germany. In Paris, he returned back not only to Judaism, but he went back to the yeshiva, to the parochial school, the rabbinical academy, and studied to become a rabbi, as if to undo the horrible war years and to pursue the career and the spiritual calling that he felt was truly his. But Paris was the first large city that he ever really lived in. And the allure of the great city of Paris, even though it was a gray city after World War II, was so exciting that he lived a double life there too, in a certain sense. He was a yeshiva student during the day, but at night, he liked to go to the Parisian cabarets and night spots, a place where no rabbi should be seen. So in a much less dangerous sense than during the war, he continued to lead a double life.
Do you think he had survivor's guilt?
I think he had quite a bit of it. He felt that when his mother was pulled away from him on December 8th, 1941, when she was taken out to be shot with 5,000 other Jews, and he was not, he felt that he should have, by right and by conscience, joined her on her last steps. Had he done so, he would have been murdered himself, and there would have been no trace of his story to tell. So, but he nonetheless felt that pull, that he owed his mother not only a debt of gratitude, but he owed her his life. In fact, she gave him life, and he felt that he should have stood by her till the very end. But that would have been to defeat the purpose of staying alive, which she wanted him to do. She told him before she was killed, do everything possible to remain alive and to remain a Jew. And he did. He had to negate his Jewishness in order to reclaim it after the war.
Let's talk about the book. When did you get the idea or start to think about writing it?
Well, I grew up with the concept of the book because I heard it, as I mentioned, every Friday night and Saturday at the Sabbath table. But as I became more aware of the depth and the horror of the Holocaust, I realized that my father's story was a little different, that very few people were able to survive passing both as a Christian and as a Muslim at the same time. And my father, to make sure that he could survive, in the end faked his way into the belly of the beast, the Nazi SS, the Waffen-SS, which was the motorized unit of the German army and the shock troops, as it were, of the Nazi force. And so he felt a sense of that everything had to be done to make him survive. And he succeeded at doing that.
Something that I thought was interesting about the book, and for the first few pages confused me a little bit, I will admit, is that you are writing it from your point of view. In other words, you refer to your father as father. You're not saying Joseph, you're saying father. And so for the first few pages, I wasn't sure if you were referring to your father or he was referring to his father.
Well, I wrote it in the third person. So I'm writing, the subtitle of the book is A Son's Memoir.
Yes.
But because my father had to hide and negate his personality in order to survive, I myself tried to sort of become a shadow in the book itself so that my father's world could come forth. I didn't want to make it my story. I wanted to make it his story as much as possible. But the first few pages is an introduction, and in which I sort of convey a little bit of the motivation of what made me write this story in the first place. And then I get into the thick of the story.
But I thought that was a very interesting thing to do, because obviously, if it weren't for him, you wouldn't be here. And you are kind of including yourself as a part of your father's story. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, at one of the same time, I wanted to convey his story, but I wanted for his story to live on the page as much as possible. I was the medium through which the story would be told, but I wanted to be as clear as glass, so that my father's story would emerge in its entirety.
Was your father still alive when you were writing the book and when it was published?
Yes, I'm happy to say that he was, and he was very happy to see it published, partly because he, as I said, during the war could not share the terror and the dread that he felt with anyone, because it was far too dangerous. And in this respect, he is rather unusual, because anyone else who survived either in hiding, so somebody else was aware of what was going on, or in the underground where there were other Jews who were fighting together, or in a concentration camp where everyone knew that they were Jews. Here, no one, but absolutely no one could know that he was a Jew, and he had to make sure that his Christian and Muslim identity was rock solid and that no one could see through it.
Did he help you write the book?
He didn't help me actually write it, but his very capacious memory helped me to draw characters, the scenery, and the inner dread and anguish that shadowed him day and night during those five horrible years.
That was sort of the next thing I was going to ask you about. Did you imagine the dialogues? Did he help you with the dialogues? I mean, did he actually tell them to you, and as well as his own feelings at the time? How much of this was novelized, let's say?
Well, I tried to adhere as closely to the story as possible. Most of the dialogue is actually taken from his memory. Sometimes the background or the weather or the landscape or certain particulars might have been slightly imagined, but especially the dialogue, I tried to be very faithful and adhere to what in fact was said at the time. And one of the reasons that he does end up volunteering for the Nazi SS, not that he wanted to, but that he feared that his identity was about to be blown by one of the slave laborers on the farm. And so some of the things that were said that sparked his fear, I quoted word for word. I wanted to be as faithful and as loyal to what was said and to what he felt at the moment of greatest peril.
Because something very interesting about this book is that it reads like a novel, even though it isn't really. I mean, it's a very easy book to read. It's not what you would call a Holocaust book, even though it is.
Yes, well, it is, in a sense, my father's story is a story of creating freedom within the iron web, as opposed to people who were trapped in a concentration camp and couldn't do anything, and their life was really purely a matter of chance. My father did create this zone of freedom within this iron web. And so it's a unique story in that respect. Every survival story of the Holocaust is unique in its own way, but this is a different kind of story. And so I felt it needed to be told, because how many rabbinical students ended up passing as both Christian and Muslim and faked their way into the Nazi SS and came out of it with still a sense of wholeness. He came back to Judaism. And so the wheel comes full circle, and it's a story of the ultimate triumph of freedom over harsh and desperate necessity.
Did you do any other research for the book, any research on your own, or did you just rely on what your father told you personally?
I did do some research. My father passed as a Muslim. He passed as a Muslim Tatar. Tatars were the descendants of the Mongols who had come all the way east and had settled in Poland and Lithuania, and they were known as Tatars. And so my father knew who they were because he was passing as one of them, but I wanted to know more of the history of how these descendants of the Mongols had actually arrived in Poland and how they had become integrated into Polish life, even though they were Muslims, and so they were also outsiders like Jews in some ways, but they were great horsemen, and the Poles admired them for their skills, their martial skills. And so I needed to study more of that part of Eastern European history, which I found fascinating. And in the end, it was pivotal to my father's survival.
How was the book received when it first came out, especially by other members of your family or by other survivors? I mean, on a personal level, not by critics.
Yeah, well, my father was a little bit fearful because, you know, he ended up faking his way into the Waffen-SS, the most horrible part of the Nazi regime, the militarized forces. And so he felt that people who would not read the book carefully would say, oh, he's a collaborator, and not see that this was a desperate attempt to survive something that his mother commanded him just before she was killed by the SS themselves. So it's a story that has lots of inner contradictions, but in the end, I think he followed a higher conscience, which in Judaism says that life is all important. And as the conversos in medieval Spain often had to assume a different religion for their survival, they never forgot that they were Jews. And so the story harks back to not only medieval history, but to ancient history, the fact that Jews have always been loyal to who they are, and at the very essence of their being lies their Jewishness.
Finally, I wanted to ask you to tell us briefly about the Joseph Skakin Project.
Yes, thanks for asking. In memory of my father and his unusual interfaith survival, I set up a nonprofit, tax-free organization called the Joseph Skakin Project, which seeks to teach and instruct people on the creative uses of adversity. My father was flung into the abyss and had to quickly create new identities for himself, first Christian, then Muslim, then Lithuanian, Polish, Russian, anything that would work to help him survive. And so this foundation is an attempt to bring a creative and theatrical approach to my father's story and to use it as a bridge to bring people together, a bridge across the abyss of time and history to bring people together and to realize that he had to draw on all three Abrahamic faiths, his native Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, to make it across the Great Divide and to make it out alive from the pit of hell. And so this organization is based, this nonprofit is based on the history as a way of teaching humanity the strength and the resiliency of the human spirit.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us that we might have left out?
I feel that this story is perennially fresh, as I mentioned. Even though it was published years ago, its message of that one needs to, all faith is rooted in each other and in one another. So that Christianity, Judaism, and Islam at their root are, if not the same, then fueled by the same spirit, the spirit of one God, of the unity of mankind, and the fact that humanity is conjoined in the deepest sense.
Well, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And it's been a great joy to speak with you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.